Now, by the mid-19th century, Americans, particularly Americans of means, who could create their own destinies, were so obsessed with the idea of the building as an individual statement, they tended to throw the literal forms of the temple aside because they viewed classical architecture as too uniform to suit their extraordinary individuality. And in America, we are obsessed with our individuality, often to the expense of our cities and our coherent culture. But in a house like Olana, built by the painter Frederick Church, working with the English-born architect Calvert Vaux on the Hudson, you see how we could carry this idea of autobiography to the heights of, beyond the heights of reason almost. Church, who painted scenes of life in, and nature in Turkey and the Orient, but did most of his painting in a studio on Manhattan Island after making many sketching trips, built this house on the Hudson as a dream of Oriental splendor. Or not so far from home, in Natchez, this house called Nutt's Folly, Samuel Sloan's great octagonal house in which the owner and the architect collaborated to make a kind of madly individualistic, absolutely juicy, let it all hang out, I've got money, what the hell, kind of house of 1860. And we have this urge, and there's no other country in the world that has ever made so many houses for so many average Joes and Janes. Everybody has two nickels in America and builds a house, and if they can't build it, they buy it or they get a trailer and then they start tinkering with it. And it is a unique in the Western world to our society to the extent that it does. And so we each build our autobiographies. Somewhere along the way, we lost the thread with our cities. We don't think of our cities as part of our autobiographies. We must rethink of that again. There are plenty of examples of that, if you see the programs, about that. But in our time, it's been very hard for us to come to grips with that problem. And one reason it's been hard, too, is because of that bugaboo, the machine. The machine which made it possible for us to all have two nickels and a lot more, and made it possible for us to conquer the country, the machine also depersonalized architecture. Because architecture could be ordered on the telephone, architecture could be made in a factory in one part of the country and trucked over to another part, or even made in one continent and sent to another. That all came to a perfect head in 1851 in the Crystal Palace in London by Joseph Paxton, who is a landscape architect and a gardener, more than an architect, who built this great exhibition under Prince Albert, in which all the work of the industrial world was on display in this vast building, so big the trees grew inside it. In Hyde Park it was originally, then moved to another site, where it lasted until 1936 when it was burned in 1936. But the point of it is that when Paxton used the machine to create this building larger than anything else before, prefabricated, built in a matter of months, he did not throw away the great traditions of classical architecture. He made the building look like a palace so that it earned the title that it was given. He used classical composition, a great emphasized center, the vaulted ceiling. He used cross axes. It was perfectly clear how to find your way around it. Grand and fundamentally Roman. He understood that in order to make something that was new, you didn't throw away the form of the past. You realized it in a new way. He saw the past as usable for a new purpose. And that's really the fundamental thing that great architecture has always been united by. But we have had some slight aberrations in the last 100 years. Now, the history of modernism, with its premise that the past was meaningless or no longer applied because of technology, is a complicated story. I cannot go into it tonight. Some of you surely know about it, all of you probably. And it is not that modernism did not produce great works of architecture. It is that it did not produce a culture, a language, and a culture of architecture that could create wonderful cities and places, because it fundamentally was against placemaking. Placemaking implies memory and the recollection of the past. Just as if you make a room, you put your pictures of your ancestors up, or you buy ancestors in the shop, or whatever, or your kids put rock heroes up and their ancestors. You got to have those things to make a place. Few of us can live like Zen monks. Now, represented by this drawing by Mies van der Rohe, the centenary we are celebrating this year, for a project in Berlin, the whole idea of the glass skyscraper, as he interpreted Paxton's building, was to get rid of all the memory and just make it what it was: walls, windows, columns, and the things that happened inside. His reaction against bourgeois culture, his reaction against the defeat of the Germans in the First World War, and many other things are behind this. We cannot deal with that. But when Mies came to this country and he built that architecture, we adopted it hook, line, and sinker. His Lakeshore Drive apartments or his Seagram building in New York are brilliant works of architecture, but their messages for what a city could be are very questionable messages, it seems to me. And we are still, as architects and clients, ambivalent in our attitude to these buildings. But the architecture is not a matter of just function. It's not a matter of structural expression. It's not just about the way things are. It must be about the way they were, the way they are, and the combination of those two in order to influence the way they will be. And Mies denied the way they were except in a negative way. That is a fundamental problem. And the problem in the hands of less wonderful architects, after all, Mies was one of the great architects in the history of architecture. Most of the Miesians are not so good. When I went to school, we called Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill three blind Mies. They were the best of the interpreters. This is Denver. It could be Memphis if you'd strike oil here. God save you from it. It's a terrible place. And what Mies said, it's completely thrown out here, but what we're left with is a series of buildings that have nothing to say, nothing to offer. They're just how much space can we legally build on the place, how many windows can we line up in a row so that we can have how many junior account executives lined up there. A building is the same at the bottom as at the top. In fact, every floor is the same, so that there shall be no doubt that we're all citizens of the same ordinary, reduced, boring corporate world. We are coming out of that period, but we have never had such a building boom as we've had in the last 40 years in this country, and it will take us a generation to recover from the banalities, the repetition, and the pure ugliness of the buildings that were built. The destruction of the streetscape, the life of the street, the form of the street, and so forth. Therefore, Rhodes College is a very privileged place. It hasn't got one international style building. There is no campus that's awake in the United States that can claim that. Hurrah for it. Now, I talked about these colonial buildings, which are citizens of the 1776 era, looked back with complete horror upon. But by 1876, recovering from the Civil War, from the corruption of Reconstruction and the Grant Administration, from the excesses of Omana or Nuts Folly, people began to say, wait a minute, we have to put this country back together again, because it was ripped apart. And what do we have in common? Well, the only shared experience that was far enough back that it wasn't tinged by the blight of the slavery situation and the Civil War was the colonial past, and particularly the New England colonial past with all its high-mindedness. And so people began to look at buildings of the colonial past, which were by and large where they existed in places like East Hampton, which I know very well, and others, Newport, were completely wrecks, because the only people who lived in old colonial houses were the people who hadn't made it. But we artists, Winslow Homer, Childe Hassam, and so forth, went out from the city, discovered these buildings, and in their art and in their imaginations saw charm in these old buildings. Then, where the artists go, as the painter Barnett Newman pointed out, real estate follows very quickly. I'm sure I'm sounding like Robert Hughes now. It's true. And came out the ministers with the next settlers of places like East Hampton, and quickly the ministers' rich parishioners came out and transformed these old houses into wonderful little charming places. This is Home Sweet Home, where John Howard Payne, an American expatriate, he hated America, was working in London, and he needed money, and he wrote a song, which became a big hit of 1823, Home Sweet Home. He wrote about a house his family lived in East Hampton. They didn't even own the house. They only rented the house. And they were poor, dirt poor. But by writing that, suddenly he transformed it. The lens of history is fundamental in the making of myths. And in a democracy, more than anywhere else, where we don't have a hierarchy of aristocracy to tell us how to behave, where we all are equal, it's those myths, that lens of history, that is fundamental to making it possible for the whole bloody thing to work. In any case, East Hampton's very interesting as... I have written a little book or part of a book about how the resort community grew up in East Hampton. And I've written about it because I'm interested in it as an architect and as a summertime citizen of this town, and because it illustrated long before the television program some ideas I sensed about what American architecture is about. So influenced by the recovery of the past, these ministers came out, and these businessmen, and they began to build big houses to suit the 19th century expanded pocketbooks and sense. But they built them modern houses with all the conveniences, sunnier rooms, big high ceilings, none of this cringing around by ye old hearth for us. But they built it in a way that related to the old architecture. This house is about a 5-minute walk from Home Sweet Home. And surely you're making a trip through time as well as space as you walk, but you're not moving from one world or one planet to another planet. You are in the presence of an ongoing conversation across time, which is the fundamental thing architecture must be. Now, I've had the privilege of building in this town myself, and almost 100 years later than the previous house, 60 years later, and another 5-minute walk sandwiched in amidst houses like the one I just showed you, I've done this house. And, of course, this is in the classic example, you're now witnessing the classic example of the architect lecture, in which you back up your puny efforts in the present with the authority of historic argument. So you must now realize you're in a swing point in this talk. But it is clear in my mind that what I was trying to do, trained in modernism at Yale in the 1960s, trained to believe that architecture had an irretrievable break with the past, but sitting in a wonderful building by Lewis Kahn, which we Mr. Harover and I were talking about before, looking out from the window at the beautiful Gothic campus of Yale, including buildings by Day and Clauder, who did the college across the street, I began to wonder what was the past. Because those buildings were built in up to 1941, when the war stopped the construction. I was born when those buildings were still being built. So they weren't all that old. But how much more convincing, wonderful, loving, and meaningful they were to so many people than the extremely interesting but very abstract and strange building in which I was forced to spend many of my days and many of my nights learning to be an architect. In any case, having had that perception, it's taken me 10 or 15 or 20 years, I guess, to figure out how to do that, how to turn that perception into architecture. This house picks up from where that other house I showed you before leaves off. It is my interpretation. It's grander in scale, smaller in size, bigger in its individual elements. Its plan is clearer, more rational, with regular spaces, though the spaces are not necessarily... Sorry, I'm so far from the screen. I don't think I have anything to point with. You'll have to follow it if you can, I'm sorry. But you see there are big, clear spaces, but they are not irregularly arranged, so there is a kind of sense of growth over time or a natural movement through the house, yet the architecture is disciplined to the classical method of composition, of regularity and clarity, and the use of the orders to set the scale, to make places, to make a little that porch into a little colonnaded screen, if you will, a special place between inside and outside. Now, the light language that this house is exploring is the language of the shingle style, which the name of which was coined by Vincent Scully, one of my teachers at Yale, in the 1950s when he was studying American architecture, and which he was one of the first in a long time, if ever, to say American architecture had forged something special of its own in the 19th century when it looked back to the colonial past and married those forms to the international traditions of classical architecture and English house planning as it was practiced in the 19th century, created something uniquely American, as Jefferson had, and something that for the first time was taken notice of abroad. That shingle style seems to me not something as a closed book, but something capable of being explored ever since. And in this house, elements that were introduced to the shingle style in the 19th century by Stanford White, one of its leading practitioners, say the French Norman tower I've used here, made a screened porch of it, cut it away free from the house, so it's composed like so many objects in a cubist painting, if you will. It's not that holistic, simplistic world of the 19th century, simpler world. It is more complicated, and I try to introduce those complexities into the composition. On the other hand, the simple ways that we still can put buildings together, well-crafted in wood, the craftsmanship is available to us if we but ask for it. The way the stone is being laid across the road, sure, it's expensive, but whoever said architecture should be cheap? Did they nickel and dime it on the Parthenon? Absolutely not. You must, if you're going to have architecture, you have to be prepared to pay for it. Everyone's perfectly prepared to pay ridiculous prices for paintings at Sotheby's. Why not ridiculous prices for beautiful buildings that we all can enjoy? Less is not more. Mies was wrong. He understood perfectly well how wrong he was, since the Seagram Building was the most expensive building ever built in its time. More is more. And that is a fundamental problem with the architecture we have, and a terrible problem for downtown Memphis, because all the buildings that I saw there were competing with each other to be cheaper, not better. In any case, I have had to learn, as any architect in this room, I'll wager, has to learn how to put things together, how wonderfully rich the craft of architecture was. And Jefferson had to train the nation to not only to make the classical architecture, but to put it together. And that is something we must do once again. Those old forms grew out of a love of craft and how to put things together, and we can't just assembly line it as we once believed. That doesn't mean we only do things just as they were. For example, we have improvements. Technology is a way to make things the way we want them, but better, so that the base of those columns is not wood, which rots, but wonderful aluminum, which will last forever, longer than Pentelic marble, probably. And we can do those things, but every brick, every shingle, every piece of wood has to be learned. And I speak as an architect with many architects of great talent working for me. We had to learn it ourselves. Schools don't teach it, and most importantly, the society as a whole has devalued it. It's our responsibility to bring it back, to show them what they have been missing. Now, I've done many houses using this shingled vocabulary. If you dig yourself into a tradition and you dig yourself into a place or a series of places that have a common thread of meaning, as the resort communities in the Northeast, you discover this world of this vocabulary. It's like learning French the first time you speak haltingly and ineptly, and the grammar's wrong, and you have 12 words, and you're lucky if you can order a sausage sandwich in a cafe. But if you stay with it long enough, you speaking beautifully, and you can order like Briat Savarin and have fabulous meals. So I too have tried. I'm not up to Savarin yet, but I'm somewhere beyond sausage, I hope. And this house on the Vineyard, with its temple-like entrance, asymmetrical entrance on the side, the door on the side, so that it's both grand and informal, classical and vernacular, the use of the material, the low scale, the horizontal spread of the roofs, the complexity of the plan, is resolved on a regular bay pattern, but if you take the typical, the main space, the living room on the left, for those of you who can follow plans, you'll see the bow windows, bay octagon shapes, deep fireplace corners pull in to give that space variety. In America, where we, particularly in the north and climates, where we spend so, and in fact in the south because of the extreme heat, in the, we spend so much time indoors in America. One of the themes on the television program is the whole, one of the programs devoted to the internalization of what is normally exterior space in Europe. We must make inner landscapes out of our architecture. We must use, learn to develop rooms inside that have the qualities of outside space, as indeed the inside of this wonderful room that we're in now, which is a great colonnade space. Are we in a public place, and are those buildings to the side, and do people live behind those windows and look at us, or are we in the room, and is that outside? That's ambiguous. So therefore, when we are in this space, we feel we have to be on our best behavior. It really is a public room. Contrast this with the typical auditorium of the last 30 years, which has no architecture. It's just a room with downlights in it and air conditioning ducts. And we don't know how to behave. In any case, that's what I've tried to do here. Here you see the house as it moves back to the rear, where it opens in broad porches. The porches provide places to sit, shade the house from the summer sun, give the house a distinct difference between front and back, just as each of us has, so we can empathize with it and know how to behave. Our place at the front as a guest, our place at the back as a potential guest, our place at the back as a welcome member of the family. The living room itself moves in complex shapes. Ceiling is low, as in the 18th century or 17th century colonial houses. The beams are added in to stretch, to push you down and to stretch you out horizontally, to make you sense of feel very cozy and giant and important in the space, and yet open it to the distant landscape, which in this case enjoys wonderful views in the opposite direction of the sea. Here you see those bays of space which allow you to move outside the room and look beyond it, so you can be in the comfort of the house and yet sense yourself being outside it at once. That wonderful ambiguity that a rich and complex language of architecture can give you. And the stair leading up in this house, which has a public quality. A stair is not just a machine for going up to the bedroom in. A stair is an opportunity for the social interchanges of family life or public life, whether it's the Spanish steps in Rome or a grand stair in a Georgian colonial house or what have you in between. The stair is an opportunity for ceremony, for casual encounter, and so forth. In the modernist devaluation of meaning, the stair became either the ramp, which was a kind of quick run up and down, or the circular spiral, which doesn't even allow the passage or encourage the passage of people by each other, and certainly doesn't invite pausing, encounter, conversation, recollection, and memory. Another house on the same island, different site, creates and a different kind of complication of program, creates a different kind of shape, a big gable, that fundamental temple-like form again, with its own propylaea in front of it to create a small entrance space in an otherwise undifferentiated site. A very complex plan, I wouldn't bore you with the details, but a million different kinds of spaces. But in modernist architecture, in which there was no subject of architecture in historical terms, you only had the structure and the function of the building. Hence, modernist buildings tended to take the complexities of the plan and make them all hang out. You know, it was let it all hang out architecture. We got all these iggledy-piggledy buildings with millions of shapes. The classical manner, the great tradition of architecture, combines them together to create a communal, larger scale public image. So I had in mind here, typically, this is not a temple, it's a house as a temple. We are not even 19th century people. We're with servants and formalities. We don't even know the difference in our society between the front door and the back door anymore. So I solved that by putting the two of them next to each other. Depends what you're wearing. If you come in your suit, or since it's a summer resort, let's say you're smartly tailored Ralph Lauren blazer, you go to the front door. If you're in your smartly tailored Ralph Lauren jeans cut off, you go in the back door. What's the difference? It's how you behave. The architecture tells you this is the way you can do one thing, this is you can do another, and then you are free, you are released to be yourself, because the architecture gives you orders, but doesn't force you. It gives you choices, really, not orders so much. In any case, here that idea of the room as a public space within the house, the idea that the house has hierarchies of privacy. You have the living room, beyond it the bedrooms above, which actually, in part, look out over the living room to the view beyond. This is one of the living rooms. Here's another, the two master bedrooms above. Look across the space and to beyond. Similarly, the conflict between our desire in the 20th century to have maximize light and air and view, which was not a preoccupation of the Victorians. On the other hand, the need to frame that view, to create a sense of place, and to bring that vastness into focus, like through the lens of a camera, to see, to hone in on some part of it so that it all doesn't go away in an instant. We do that with the traditional age-old American window, double-hung window, but also with the introduction of all the Mayans that modernism took out of architecture, as if it was a great feat to have a sheet of glass 6 feet by 6 feet, which left you with a gaping hole in the facade of a building. Here, with all that architecture put back in, you get shadows and intricacy and richness, which was, for so long, thought not possible. Here you are looking down at that room, and here looking up where the ceiling becomes a tented world that brings the complexities together and resolves them in a coherent silo-like shape, recalling, I think, all our memories, our fond dreams of childhood, of crawling up into a tower and being off by ourselves. Viewed from the distance across the golf course that this house faces, it is all resolved in a great temple form. Now, behind that temple is not only the abstracted notions that I've talked about of Jefferson and the houses and individual temples, it's ordinary buildings in the neighborhood. This little house, which is so good it couldn't have been designed by an architect of the 50s or 40s, because they would never have done anything so simple, in my opinion, is just an ordinary little cottage on Martha's Vineyard. And what is it but a temple with a door on the side? You know where the living room is. It's the one with the big windows. You know where the bedroom is or the kitchen. It's the little ones. And how simple and exact a statement of each of us and our desires. Wouldn't we, each of us, want to own or be in that house for some considerable period of time? Behind my intention was also a great monument of the shingle style, a house by McKim, Mead, and White of 1887, a great, perhaps the greatest expression of the house as temple in our society ever, which was torn down when I was in architecture school to be replaced by a house I would call a ranch burger. Not only was it torn down and replaced by a piece of absolute junk, but it was torn down by descendants of the people who built the house. So low, in my opinion, had our tastes fallen. So low had our conception. So how confused we had become between architecture as a cultural act and architecture as mere shelter, that this great masterpiece could be torn down. And not only was I shocked by this, but other architects, George Nelson, was shocked by it. He built a house that was an almost direct copy of it for a client of his. It happened to be in East Hampton at the time. And Robert Venturi's first house project, which brought him to the attention of many of us in 1959, was also based on this low house. It has had the incredible capacity to move a generation of architects, the house and the vandalism alike. And here at night, you can see, well, there it is. I'll shut up for a second. It's pretty. I could, and probably some of you are saying I am, going on and on, showing a variety of houses. There are many places in our society on which the strong traditions that the shingle style represents are not really dominant. There are many in this country. There are still places that we can forge traditions. There are places that many different styles have grown up. No strong will has come to put to pass to dominate them. That doesn't mean that the architecture has an excuse to be without content. In fact, it's all the more important that the architect and his client bring content to it. And there are meanings buried within architecture, buried within our own childlike visions of what a house is. Every child, you've never seen any child draw a house that looked like the Seagram building, at least not to my knowledge. They make houses that have gable roofs because that fundamental temple form, that gable, that shelter, is a part of us. So this house on the north shore of Long Island might be where Gatsby looked out for Daisy's dock. It's just the right part. Has memories of that childlike vision as seen through, sifted through the architecture of the of a favorite of mine, Sir Edwin Mutchins, and his interpretation of English cottage architecture.